Morning, all. This meeting of the Board of Environmental Protection is being held by video conference via Zoom on November 19th, 2020, beginning at 9 a.m. I am Martin Draper. I'm the chair of the Board of Environmental Protection. I am also the solid waste director for Aroostook Waste Solutions in Fort Fairfield, and I reside in Caribou. And at this time, I'd like to invite other board members to introduce themselves, beginning with Mr. Dubois.
Hi, good morning. It's Mark Dubois, Natural Resource Manager with Poland Spring, and I reside in Falmouth.
Thank you. Mr. Deshane.
I'm Bob Deshane. I reside in Hudson. I'm a retired bird guide, retired legislator, retired radio legend.
Ms. Lessard.
I'm Sue Lessard, and I'm the town manager for the town of Bucksport, and I reside in Bucksport.
Thank you. Mr. Parker.
I'm a retired civil engineer. I'm now living down on the coast, probably back in Ibiza before the winter's over.
Thank you. Mr. Pelletier?
I'm Steve Pelletier, reside in Topson, semi-retired wildlife biologist, forester, and wetland scientist.
And last but certainly not least, Mr. Sanford.
Morning, I'm Rob Sanford in Gorham, Maine. I am an environmental science and policy professor.
Thank you. Others present this morning include the acting commissioner, Melanie Loizen, the board's executive analyst, Bill Hinkle, the board's administrative assistant, Ruth Ann Burke, and our former executive analyst, Cindy Bertacci. Assisting us this morning or for this meeting are assistant attorneys general, Peggy Benziger and Laura Jensen. And I understand Ms. Benziger has a couple of other new members to her staff that she wanted to introduce. So I'd give her the opportunity to do that now.
Thank you. I want to introduce Caleb Elwell, who recently joined our office, a couple months ago. Caleb grew up in Heartland, Maine, and attended the University of Maine undergrad and Vanderbilt Law School. He lives in Belfast. And Caleb, do you want to just tell the board where you came from before you joined the AG's office?
Hi, everyone. Prior to coming here at the Attorney General's office, I clerked for 2 years for a federal judge in West Virginia. I'm happy to be back in Maine.
In West Virginia, yes. Thank you. The the newest new guy is Bob Martin. Bob grew up in Illinois and went to the University of Illinois and then came east and went to NYU Law School. Bob lives in Portland. And Bob, are you on? Can you tell us where you worked before you came to the Attorney General's office?
Yep, I'm here. Hello, everyone. Nice to virtually meet you all. I worked for about 5 years City Law Department, practicing a mixture of environmental and administrative law before moving up here to Maine a few months ago.
Yes, from the New York City Law Department. Thank you. And you'll be seeing these faces at future board meetings. Caleb is at present taking over shoreland zoning and advising the Land Use Planning Commission, gradually taking over that. And Bob is taking over Mary Sauer's position, doing all things having to do with oil, and both of them are also going to pinch hit on various other cases for us. Thanks.
Thank you, and welcome to both of you. And the next item on our agenda is Nordic Aqua Farms, and I will be turning the podium over to Mr. Deshane, the presiding officer for this matter.
Thank you. Everybody buckle your seatbelts. Today, the board is considering proposed board orders for each of Nordic's applications. Before beginning our deliberations, each of the parties has been allotted 5 minutes for a closing argument. Please keep in mind that the record is closed, and so no references to new evidence or evidence outside of the record will be allowed. There will be no questions and no rebuttal. Following closing arguments, Ms. Benziger will review the board's options. The board will then consider the air emissions application, followed by the waste discharge license application, and finally, the site law NERPA application. Board members who are not participating in the review of a specific application will leave the meeting and turn off their cameras. Ms. Bertacci did do some outreach to the interveners to see who would be interested in testifying. The names I know have expressed interest include Upstream Watch, University of New England, and Nordic. Just because you didn't respond to that request doesn't preclude you as an intervener from being able to testify, but if you could signify now that you are interested, that would just help us with the process. And you can simply buzz in as needed later on. Ms. Tucker, okay. So with that in mind, I think we can probably just go right to upstream watch first. If there's no caretaking that needs to happen, Ms. Lessard or Ms. Bertacci.
The sequence of these applications means I can be in on one and then have to go away on the second one. And am I completely logging off and then logging back in for that? Because simply my understanding is that I wasn't even supposed to be in the same planet. But certain ones were supposed to, and that applies to Mr. Draper as well. So Ms. Bensinger, maybe you could clarify for me what I'm supposed to do.
Yes, our advice is the best course is for you to leave the meeting, which would be log off. Then if you have to come back later, maybe Ms. Bertacci can let you know when it's time to come back.
Because that was my question, is if I go away, I don't know when I could come back. That would be...
Ms. Burke maybe can let you know, just stay close at hand.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'll send an email when it's time to come back.
And I guess procedurally, I would have a question as well for Ms. Bensinger. These closing arguments that we're about to hear for 5 minutes worth could touch on some of the permits where some members are supposed to be recused. My understanding is these are general closing arguments. We're not going to go any great depth, but we are at the request really of a lot of interveners considering the entire package as well. And it's appropriate for the board members who have recused from certain parts of it to sit in the conversation.
Yes, so I think all board members can listen to the closing arguments, and I might just remind everyone, it isn't testimony, it's closing arguments, and all board members may and should listen to the closing arguments.
Mr. Draper.
Just again, procedural questions similar to Ms. Lessard, and a note to Ruth Ann, who I'm sure is still listening, but has her camera turned off. I will not be able to get email. So if you could call me on my cell phone, if you have that number, that would work better for me, please.
Great. Any other procedural questions, or can we go ahead with closing arguments? I will start with upstream watch. Mr. Losey, I'm looking for you to see if you are available. Welcome.
I am, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you briefly this morning. We have 2 points to make. The first is with regard to the application requirements. An application requirement is not the same thing as a permit condition. An application requirement precedes the issuance of a permit, and its absence precludes the issuance of a permit. The latter follows the issuance of a permit and ensures the permit's proper and effective use. They're not the same and they're not interchangeable. In order to be awarded a permit, every applicant must demonstrate in its application that it meets the application requirements or criteria. This demonstration is a mandatory precedent to the issuance of a permit. The courts have supported this view. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit expressed it well. When a government body grants a license, it is an adjudication that the applicant has satisfactorily complied with the prescribed standards for an award of that license. Not that they've agreed to or promised to, they have satisfactorily complied. Similarly, the denial of a license is based on an adjudication that the applicant has not satisfied those qualifications and requirements. Not next week or 2 years from now, now. There's an exception in Maine, the Belgrade Shores case, which says for minor, easily corrected matters, we need not be all that strict. But that's not what we're talking about here when we're talking about things like the dye test and other things, which I won't go into because they could get into permit specific requirements. These are not minor, easily corrected. And yet, Staff proposes to allow compliance with application requirements by after-the-fact permit conditions. That is as illogical as it is illegal. When an application calls for a demonstration that certain environmental criteria will not be exceeded by operation of the proposed facility, it must demonstrate that as part of the application. An applicant may not just show, for example, modeling without verification in the field to demonstrate that they've met the criteria. It is unlawful and useless to allow an application, to allow an applicant to satisfy the application criteria after the facility is completed. In this case, after the forest and the wetlands and the habitat have been destroyed, to determine whether, with that after the fact testing, the applicant was telling you the truth from the beginning. It's too late. Worse, bigger problem, goes well beyond Nordic. If DEP staff is allowed to recommend waiving compliance with application criteria in favor of permit conditions on an after the fact basis, what are the criteria for making that decision? What guides the DEP staff to say, well, this criteria we can push off into the future, but this other one we can't? What criteria, published criteria that the public can have confidence in, guides the staff in saying, we can do this for this applicant, but we can't do it for that applicant? That is a slippery slope on which the state of Maine should not choose to set foot. On a similar subject, a number of times over the last several months, you've asked questions of Nordic. Good questions. Usually, but not always, you received answers. Almost always, you received responses. But did those responses answer your questions? Or were the responses non-responsive piles of paperwork from Ransom that didn't answer your questions? I ask you to go back and look. Look at your questions, think about what you were asking, and ask yourself if all that paperwork that came in actually answered your questions. You are entitled to proper answers to your questions. Finally, I need to respond to the remarks of the presiding officer at your last meeting. It wasn't something that Upstream wanted to discuss, but Mr. Duchesne said that he was concerned because he sensed that several members of the public, interveners, or interested parties feared that permit approval was a foregone conclusion. He cautioned us that BEP has no predetermined outcome and that members don't even talk to each other about this and haven't. As they say, Upstream would prefer not to even get into this issue, but since it is raised, we're in an awkward position. If we say nothing, we are acquiescing in the veracity of what the chairman has said. Let me make it clear. At this point, Upstream Watch has no reason to believe that BEP or any of its members have predetermined anything or are in any way biased. But why did Mr. Duchesne make that comment? Well, I believe it was October 3rd. We woke up in the morning and found our morning paper told us that Nordic had said they got their permits and they're getting ready to start. How do you think that made us feel when we thought a process was still going on? There are the obvious issues that we briefed, the air emission sources outside of the generators, financial capacity arguments. We briefed these things, and yet it appears but staff ignored everything that we said. We're really not all that stupid, and our witnesses aren't that bad to be totally ignored. Consider May 20th, Mr. Wood's presentation to you about the dilution ratios. Without getting into whether 300 to 1 or 530 to 1 is the correct ratio, consider what happened. The record closed in February. A call was made from Nordic to DEP in May, following which a change was made. We are told a recalculation, and a significant part of that application changed. We asked that same day, send an email, show us your calculations, show your work. Never responded to. We later asked in writing, and I mean later, the next few days, we asked whether when the call was made, who performed the recalculations, who helped, were the superiors at DEP informed, who from Nordic called them, what the caller said and asked them to do, when the call came in, who else from DEP was involved. Never received a response. Wouldn't that make you feel nervous? You know, you can say that that's a recalculation, that it's not testimony, but when you change the theory, a theory which had come in under oath and been tested by cross-examination, you change it to something which has no test, no cross-examination. You're accepting testimony after the record is closed. You can call it whatever you want, but that's what it is. And as
if I may just interrupt, Mr. Pelosi, I'm going to be lenient with time at all. I believe you've probably gone 7 out of your 5 minutes so far, and I'm willing to let this go on a little longer. I just want to have some concept of when you might be wrapping up.
Mr. Duchesne, I can understand from your grace in handling this entire matter why you were the dean, would you call yourself the legend of radio? that was our concluding point. And I thank all of you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I'm pleased to say that I'm able to do so at last as a member of the Maine Bar. I was held out for 18 months after passing the exam and submitting my credentials. I expected to represent the board, the Epstein, before your board at the hearings. I was precluded from doing so. I was never given a reason. I still don't know the reason, but someday I will. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. I believe we can go to University of New England next. I believe Mr. Costa Pierce is available to speak to us.
My name is Barry Costa Pierce, and I'm in Biddeford, Maine at the University of New England campus. I'm an aquaculture scientist at the University of New England who's worked in the field for over 40 years throughout the world. For 20 years of this, I was the editor-in-chief of the journal Aquaculture, the top scientific journal in the world in that scientific field. I am very grateful to have been part of this process and to learn from the board and their professional actions throughout this two plus year period. And I'd like to summarize for you my scientific testimony for the board, which has been previously given to you. First of all, the environmental impacts of the planned discharges, all of the plans submitted by Nordic and by the Department of Marine Resources, in my view, are acceptable in every scientific evaluation we can make. They meet the highest standards for environmental stewardship. If you look at it in a very basic sense, Penobscot Bay is a very tidally powerful bay, which exchanges over 2.6 trillion gallons of water a day. Discharges by Nordic of 7.7 million gallons a day may appear great to that, but when looking at the daily exchanges of that oceanographic region, it's the equivalent of one drop in a 5-gallon bucket. At these proposed levels of discharges, there will be absolutely no impacts on bay-wide temperatures or salinities. And as for the water that Nordic does plan to extract, they plan to have the best production efficiencies for food production water use that any terrestrial protein production system cannot meet. So the amount of water use per pound of high quality, healthy salmon produced is far in those efficiencies far exceed any other chicken, pork, or other terrestrial system. Nordic will have one of the world's most sophisticated waste treatment systems that we have looked at in anywhere throughout the world, of which we have RAS aquaculture experts, 3 of them on our staff. with state-of-the-art microfiltration screening of such a small size that even bacteria will be removed. Nordic will employ expensive, very expensive, and state-of-the-art denitrification technology to remove the nitrate nitrogen coming from the soluble nitrogen coming from the fish waste to nitrogen gas, discharging it harmlessly to the atmosphere because the atmosphere contains over 70% nitrogen. Nordic will remove about 85% of the total nitrogen, which would exceed the performance of any sewage treatment, wastewater treatment system of its comparable size in the state of Maine. 99% of the solids, 99% of the biological oxygen demand, and 99% of the phosphorus will be removed. This is very, very impressive. According to a study that examined the nitrogen sources and transport mechanisms to Penobscot Bay, three studies that we have examined, most of the inputs of nitrogen to that bay, 66%, didn't come from surface waters. They came from atmospheric dry deposition coming from the winds to the west, 66%. Only 4% of the total nitrogen discharges to Penobscot Bay come from point source discharges, mainly sewage treatment plants. Nordic's planned nitrogen discharge will add less than 1% to that point source discharges and far below that to the total nitrogen, which will, and the position of the pipes make it extremely unlikely to add to harmful algal blooms or other nitrogen-caused acidification problems to the bay. Food conversion ratios have been discussed a lot. Food production ratios in this production facility are expected to be 1.1 pounds of dry feed to 1 pound of wet salmon fish weight produced. Cattle production is 16 to 20. Chickens are comparable, but nowhere near the waste of chickens that the bay waste from chickens that the bay produced in the past cause enormous environmental problems because chicken waste has the highest amount of digestible energy still left in their feces. Not so with cold-blooded salmon. Nordic plans to then not only meet this 1.1, but also to advance the industry-wide standard, as the company is actually at the forefront internationally of sourcing the most sustainable feeds for salmon available today. And it plans to explore all alternatives to fish meals and oils to come up with even better economically viable alternatives. Now, just today, Archer's Daniels Midland, ADM, the largest agriculture company in the US.
Excuse me, you're not allowed to you're not allowed to include in your oral argument anything outside of the record, and it sounds like you're about to go there. So
that's fine.
I would ask you to just stop. Keep your oral argument to matters within the record.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. So escapement from land-based recirculating systems is of little to no environmental concern in this case. Reported fish escapes from recirculating aquaculture systems in Norway were transfers of small fish from land-based recirculating systems on the land to boats that were docking on the coast, which transferred these small fish from recirculating systems for restocking into ocean-based pens. And that's where the escapes occurred. These escapes were not of large adult fish from recirculating aquaculture systems on land. There are stringent regulations in Norway that require three barriers to be placed between the fish grow out facilities and the environment. Nordic plans to have 12 barriers between the fish growing facility and the environment. In our professional opinion, escapement will be next to impossible, with the, of course, possible transfers, exception of deliberate illegal movements of fish. In conclusion, and thank you for this opportunity, recirculating aquaculture systems as proposed here by Nordic and Maine will not only meet our environmental standards, but exceed all of those in the world today for almost any large-scale salmon aquaculture production facility. Major sustainable seafood certification bodies, all of which market to consumers the highest available standards of production and sustainability, and employ some of the world's most respected aquaculture scientists to make their rigorous evaluations of these, all agree with us. And in my professional evaluation of the plans and proposals submitted to this board to date by this company, Nordic Aqua Farms is best in class. And thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. And I appreciate all of your hard work.
Thank you very much. Among the interveners, I believe Ms. Tucker is still there in the queue. Is there any other intervener who had planned or hoped to speak that hasn't notified us yet? And if you can do so while Ms. Tucker is going ahead with her remarks, just let us know. Otherwise, we will conclude with Nordic shortly, as soon as Ms. Tucker is done. So Ms. Tucker, go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Presiding Officer Duchesne. And on behalf of the Maine Lobstering Union and the lobstermen that I represent, as well as Jeffrey and maybe and Judith Grace, the MGL interveners, I welcome the opportunity to provide this closing. Our biggest concern has been and remains that this body is proceeding with these applications and this vote today in the absence of having any justiciable issue in front of you. There is a question of material fact regarding the easement agreement on which Nordic relies to establish title right and interest that my clients assert they have a right to. Just this morning, Judge Murray in the Superior Court case—
Excuse me, I'm sorry, you cannot talk about things outside of the record. So I would appreciate it if you would just focus on the record that is before the board.
The record before the board is deficient because all of the issues, Ms. Benzinger, have been denied the right to be putting the things in front of this board. The board is making an improper decision on these in the absence of the
Ms. Tucker.
In the absence of, I have a right to proffer this issue in front of this board. We have been denied the right to appeal to the full board. We have been denied the right to supplement the record, whereas Nordic has been allowed to supplement this record repeatedly since the record allegedly closed.
No, Ms. Tucker, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to at this time in your closing.
Then I have preserved my ability to file this challenge in an ADC. We will be filing an ADC appeal. This process has not been a due process, and I have made my record, and I am done. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good luck today.
Thank you so much. Just checking in, Mr. Lannan, did you have an interest in speaking?
Yes.
Then please go right ahead.
Thank you. I'm speaking today on behalf of the NVC. As the NVC has said all along, the NVC is not for or against this application or this project, only that the applicant get it right now before it breaks ground and before it discharges a single gallon of wastewater directly to the bay. The impact to our historic district has not been properly represented in this process, and we do not accept any of the drop of water in a bucket analogies presented, as we do not care that the solution to pollution is dilution in the aggregate for the bay. We don't care what percent removal is proposed as a goal. We only care about the long-term impact to our area of the bay. That impact assessment must include the discharge on a good day and a not so good day. The 99% removal numbers are impressive, but that means that in a day where they have 70% removal, because there's a concern, you get 1 month's worth of discharge in a single day. We are extremely concerned about a permit first approach and a demonstrate compliance later approach. We are completely opposed to this proposed, and we are completely opposed to this approach. And we discussed this in some detail at our meeting this weekend. And you know, the conclusion essentially is if you take this approach, you were putting this on us to try to come up with things within the appeal to try to get this thing corrected. And it really is going to provide an undue hardship to our small village here in Bayside. You know, we one of the last things that was proposed by the applicant was that Bayside had not announced that we were a historic district. And I think that to me sort of summarizes this whole process to date. There have been, the applicant has been pushing along little things to get things done, providing the least amount of information, and then essentially ignoring things that seem to be very important to us, their potential neighbor in the future. And it is very concerning for us. So we would like to go on the record to say that at this point, we can only see the proper approach be to return the applications to the applicant, have them properly do the right assessments up front, not as conditions, but as part of the permitting process, and get it right from the beginning, because, I mean, we call our village Bayside for a reason. It faces the village. Our entire history of 150 years has focused on this little corner of the bay, right down the street, right down the stream, right in the middle of the plumes that they are modeling. It are coming from their facility and into our mooring field, and that's very concerning for us. So I just wanted to say that. Thank you very much for your time. You guys have done yeoman's work here. I mean, you've spent so much time on this. We all have, and I appreciate that. I just don't think it's done yet. It needs to be returned and done right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lennon. I'm about to go to who had wished to speak and did not get the opportunity before we conclude. And seeing none, Ms. Taranjo, if you could go ahead with your closing remarks.
Good morning. I am actually turning it over to Eric Heim from Nordic for the Nordic's closing remarks. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning. Can you see me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good morning. So I'm just going to make some brief closing remarks. Actually, right now, as we speak, it's a 3-year anniversary since we selected the Belfast location. And today, or these days, is a big time for Maine as well to decide its future in aquaculture. So I just wanted to say, well, first of all, thank you to the board and the professional staff at EP AG for vetting this project. We know enormous amounts of effort have gone into this. And our staff and vendors have responded to all questions to the best of their ability along the way as well. And I personally permitted projects across the US and abroad. And based upon my experience, I can firmly say that the permitting in Maine holds a very high standard. We have submitted more documentation in this project than anywhere else. And to put it this way, a lot more. So, and based upon my 10 years of experience in siting these projects, you know, I can also say on behalf of us that we remain extremely happy with this site selection from a aquaculture perspective. We looked all along the eastern coastline, and Belfast is a central location where we can attract, develop, and retain talent. And that is actually a competitive factor in this industry. And it's also quite unique to actually find and have clean and cold seawater, fresh water, all in one location. It's difficult to find. And then somebody asked me, why have you put up with all the turbulence and delays in Belfast? And it's true, this process has been costly and lengthy, but making the right choice of a long-term location overrides all of that. So when we make a commitment to elected officials and citizens of any community that have opened our door to us, we take that seriously. And that's why we are still here. And we are clearly not the only ones who are sacrificed along this process. I guess that it's both sides of the aisles in this process, but we are thankful, you know, to many of the parties and persons who have believed in us. And we know there are those that still disagree with us and our plans, and we respect that. In this process, I believe everybody has been heard. We have done countless voluntary and mandatory information meetings in Belfast. We have had an open door policy for everyone to come in and talk to us, and we have shared information continuously. I wish some of those who had concerns had chosen dialogue and come more often to talk to us, but we realized that, you know, sometimes agreement cannot be reached, and we hope that will change over time if this project is approved. So, but what we have done is taken all opinions seriously and listened along the way, and many have been helpful for us in fine-tuning our proposals and plans to local conditions. And then there are some claims and opinions that simply been really hard to reconcile with reality or practical solutions, and that's just the way it is. You know, proposals for zero discharge claims that, you know, our standards are harmful to the bay compared to other solutions and that fish will escape simply do not add up with practical reality. And I think we've done a pretty extensive job in showing that. So, and I think, you know, we've invited professional scrutiny from third parties, and that's been an important part of the process for us as well, because we want to be sure that we are doing the right thing as well. And I'd like to just say that, you know, we do have the track record to prove it. We have never had an escape incident in our farms. We have never had major die-offs. We have never had major disease outbreaks, as we've told the board before. And to prove it, we have certifications with the Aquaculture Stewardship Council and Global GAP, both leading international certification organizations in sustainable aquaculture. What I'd like to say, as you know, I close this up, if approved, we will continue to listen to any concerns, and we will continue to address those through robust data and science. And, you know, at the same time, we understand that a thriving business is about community and people as well, and prosperity for those people. And, you know, and I understand some of the concerns here today, and, you know, our task is really to work to show, you know, that we have really worked through these things and have confidence that, you know, this will be a success for Belfast and the area around it. And it's important to remember our brand is built on sustainability, quality, and responsible practices. We have strong incentives to make this work for Belfast and Maine. Finally, I'd like to just say that COVID-19 and economic impacts, taken into account, this project provides a substantial investment and jobs that can play into the economic recovery of Maine without sacrificing the environment and other livelihoods. And I think, you know, it means good paying jobs for Mainers with a company that has shown and proven good employment practices, both in Belfast and our US headquarters in Portland. So we are excited about all the positives we believe we can bring to the state and the future, and of course, to the board's decision here today. So that's my closing comments. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And thank you to all the interveners who commented and did not have to take us up on the offer right now. It's been a very valuable process, I think, for the board. At this point, I would like to go to Ms. Bensinger, and we can review the board options as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Deshane. Just reviewing for board members what we've said at prior board meetings, the board has several options as it considers votes on the permit applications before it. A vote will be taken on each proposed order with the appropriate panel of eligible board members participating. For each proposed order, the options available to the board will be number one, and these are in no particular order, just the way I wrote them down. The board may vote to adopt the proposed order and the associated documents today, presumably with any errata sheet if one has been provided by the staff. Two, the board may vote to adopt the proposed order with minor changes that can be drafted and made today at this meeting, maybe after a brief recess. Three, the board may vote to direct the staff to redraft a portion or portions of the proposed order, but with the same outcome. Here, that would be an approval of that application with conditions, and return with it. The staff would return with that redrafted order, recommended order, at a future board meeting for consideration and a vote at that time. And four, the board may vote to direct the staff to draft a proposed order with the opposite outcome, which would be a denial of that particular application. And the staff would return with that recommended order at a future board meeting for consideration and a vote. If a major change in the recommended order or the opposite outcome is requested, the board must give adequate direction to the staff so that the revised or rewritten proposed order reflects the board's analysis and conclusions. If a partial change is directed, depending on how significant it is, there may be an additional public comment period required. The law requires that if a proposed order is substantially revised, an additional comment period must be provided. But the law does not specify what the length of that comment period would be. But I think to allow due process, it would depend on whether it's a total rewrite with the opposite conclusion or a partial change. If the board directs the staff to write a proposed order with the opposite outcome, obviously an additional public comment period would be required. Does anybody have any questions about the options? Thank you.
Okay, at this point, let's introduce our staff members. We have, I believe, several members from the Air Bureau on with us right now. Eric Kennedy is here. If you can just show yourself there, Eric. Jeff Crawford has already spoken up in the earlier hearing. He is with us. Kevin Ostrowski, senior meteorologist, has just popped up on my screen. Patrick Sherman is with us, I believe. Yep, there he is. And Jane Gilbert, air licensing unit manager, is with us, I believe. So those are the experts to which we will go for our questions and as we probe through this. And at this point, I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Bertacci to walk us through with the introductions and get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Duchesne. I will note at this point that Mr. Draper is not participating in the air emissions application, consideration of that application. So I believe he has left the meeting. As Presiding Officer Duchesne indicated before the board this morning, is Nordic Aquafarms' application for a new Chapter 115 minor source air emissions license. Nordic has proposed the installation of 8 2-megawatt electrical generators for its proposed land-based salmon aquaculture production facility, which would be located in Belfast and Northport. A draft proposed board order was made available for a 30-day public comment period. The board reviewed the draft order, the comments received on that draft order, and department staff response to those comments at its meeting on October 29th, 2020. At that time, the board did not request any changes to the draft proposed order. The board packet before you this morning includes a proposed board order and an associated addendum A, the response to comments, for your consideration and possible vote today. At this time, before we go to department staff, Assistant Attorney General Laura Jensen will comment on the need for the board to consider both the draft license, the draft permit, and addendum A.
Ms. Bertacci, I just wanted to note for the board briefly about the structure of this proposed order, and later on I have a note about the proposed MEPG's order, because the structures of these documents before the board affect the wording of a possible motion the board may entertain today. So with regard to the proposed air emissions license, there's two parts to the document before the board. One, the license, which includes standard and specific conditions, and this is the enforceable legal document. And then the appended response to comments, which doesn't normally, I think doesn't ordinarily appear with an air emissions license, but in this case it does, because it contains rationale and the bases that underpin the findings and conclusions in the license. So you have those two parts. And if the board were to approve the recommended order today, although it would only sign the license, it would be approving all parts of the document, including the addendum and any findings or conclusions in the addendum. Does anyone have any questions about that? That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, at this point, department staff is available to respond to any questions board members may have, any of your remaining questions about either the draft license or the response to comments in addendum A. And I believe Mr. Kennedy will be fielding those questions from board members.
looking around at board members for any indication of a question. Ms. Lessard.
Just making sure that I fully understand the conditions here. None of these conditions on this permit are conditional compliance, meaning that they require a review and approval by the department process associated with them. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. There's none that are conditional approvals.
Thank you.
Other questions from the board or discussions on any part of this point? I'll tee this one up if I might, and this is probably will recur. I think Mr. Losey hit the nail on the head when he indicated you can't correct a deficient application by putting on additional conditions. If it was deficient in the first place, it was deficient. I think the assessment some of the board members, maybe all the board members would have to deal with is, was this application so flawed that the department went beyond where it should in order to re-engineer the project on behalf of the client? And then we drifted off into a lot of discussion about the generators and on-site emissions and everything. So there was a lot to chew over. Was there anything in particular in the original application that the department feels it re-engineered?
No, there's nothing that we re-engineered. There was a change to emission limits from the engines that was based on their particular selection of an engine manufacturer. So that did reduce some of the emission limits that were originally proposed. But that's typical in a license application process for an air emission license, where sometimes proposed limits do change either up or down, depending on what the department recommends for a best available control technology determination, or as in this case, what the applicant proposed for lower emission limits, and as well as a higher, taller stacks for each of the engines.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the board? Any points of deliberation that anyone wants to discuss with parts or all of the application for the air permit? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion. Mr. Parker.
I move that we approve the application for the air discharge license, air emissions license.
Do I have a second? Mr. Pelletier seconds. Ms. Jensen.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure we get the wording of the motion correct.
You provide me the wording and I will comply.
So the wording of the motion might be that the board member moves to approve Nordic's application for a Chapter 115 minor source air emissions license and adopt the proposed board order and addendum A as presented.
I'll make my motion say that, please.
And Mr. Pelletier seconds that as well. On the record, yes, he does. Any discussion? Then apparently we can go to a vote. This will be individual votes. I'll start with Mr. Pelletier.
Yes.
Ms. Lessard.
Yes.
Mr. Parker.
Yes.
Mr. Sanford.
Yes.
And I also vote yes. So I believe that takes us off to our next permit. And do we need to contact board members to get them back in, or Ms. Bertacci?
No, we only have four members participating. Ms. Lessard is leaving at this point, since this is going to be the waste discharge application. You might want to note the department staff who are available for the purpose of discussing or responding to any questions board members may have. And with the presiding officer's permission, I'll note that they are Mr. Greg Wood, Director of the Division of Water Quality Management, Brian Kavanaugh, the Director of the Bureau of Water Quality, Rob Moeller, the Senior Environmental Engineer, and Angela Brewer, who's Biologist 3 with the Bureau of Water Quality, are all available to respond to any questions you may have. So the matter before the board at this time is Nordic's application for a main pollutant discharge elimination system permit and a waste discharge license for the discharge to Belfast Bay of up to 7.7 million gallons per day of treated effluent at full build-out. A draft proposed order and the fact sheet were available for a 30-day public comment period. Presiding Officer Deshane provided an additional 12-day comment period for persons to address a typographical error that had occurred in the fact sheet, which misstated the percent removal of phosphorus and nitrogen. The board discussed the draft proposed order and fact sheet, the comments received on the draft order, and department staff's response to that, those comments at its November 12th meeting. At that board meeting, members requested clarification of several provisions and noted some typographical errors. A revised board order and fact sheet are included in the board's packet. That begins on page 261 of the materials that were provided for today's meeting. These decision documents contain some additional typographical errors, some of which occurred when the extensive redline version was converted to a final format. Department staff has reviewed the proposed order and fact sheet and prepared an errata sheet for your consideration. I will note that that errata sheet was emailed to the parties and to board members yesterday, and Mr. Wood will review that errata sheet with you and respond to any questions you may have. But before going to Mr. Wood, again, Ms. Jensen will speak to the structure of the proposed permit and the fact sheet.
Thank you. So again, the board has a document before it that has several parts to it. These include the permit with its standard and special conditions and attachments, which is the enforceable piece. And then there are an attached fact sheet and attachments to the attached fact sheet, which includes the response to comments section. This fact sheet contains the rationale and the bases underpinning the findings and conclusions made in the permit itself. Unlike the air permit that the board just considered, the fact sheet and its contents are required by state and federal regulation for MEFI's permits in this instance. So if the board were to approve the recommended order today, although it's only signing the permit portion of this document, it would also be approving all parts of the document, including the attachments and the fact sheet and any conclusions and findings made therein. Thank you.
Great. I think at this point, we're ready for questions from the board to any members of the staff. Are there questions from the board?
Should I ask right now, before we go to specific questions, whether or not board members would like Mr. Wood to go through the errata sheet or any portion of that errata sheet? I want to make sure members had an opportunity to review it. I will note that most of those changes are very minor word changes and typographical errors, but I think it would be helpful if members had questions for Mr. Wood to speak to those at this time.
Thank you, I would agree. When I looked it over, I didn't see anything that jumped out at me, but maybe something should have. So is there anything you'd like to explain or flag for us, Mr. Wood? And right now I also see Mr. Pelletier is unmuted, so expect a question.
I'll wait, I'm fine with the errata.
No, I have nothing further, Mr. DeChane.
Okay, everyone's comfortable with the errata? Mr. Sanford.
On for item 29 and 30 on page 1447, I assume that means those insertions replace the semicolon.
Okay.
is on, so 29 on the errata sheet and number 30.
Item 29, page 40, header 13, or is inserted between 51 and causes. And I'm assuming that replaces the semicolon. Same thing for the one below it. And also on page 47 of that, I'm curious where the other quotation mark goes.
Are we able to pull up a version of the document to look at together?
I may be able to do it. Mr. Wood, do you have access to the document? I may be able to share screen. Let me try, okay? Host is disabled screen sharing. Host is disabled screen sharing. Excuse me, I'm trying to get Ms. Burke to allow me to share a screen. Can folks see this document now? All right. This is actually the errata sheet that I'm pulling up. And what you actually want to pull up is the decision document, is that correct?
Yes, on page 349, final fact sheet, it's page, which is of our packet, which is page 47 out of 62.
Well, ask Mr. Wood if he has that readily accessible. If the board members would like to take a brief recess, I could probably bring that up for you. It might take me a few minutes.
I would agree. Why don't we take 5 minutes, bathroom break, et cetera. Freshen coffee. 5 minute break?
Okay.
5 minute break. In terms of making change, that's just cosmetic and the department can do that on the permit itself, or do we have to vote that as a change should we decide to go ahead with the permit?
Page are we going to?
I think at this point, there would be the board would be asked to adopt the changes that are in the errata sheet, and we could note that there is that additional change.
Okay, was there anything else we wanted to review in terms of these wordings? Mr. Sanford, are you good?
I can close the document.
Stop. I think I'm not going to comment anymore on commas. I'm scared that I could.
Yeah, right, I know. At this point, I think we're into board. Any further questions of the department and staff? Mr. Pelletier.
And it's in everybody's interest that we're always trying to keep this, everything transparent here. And I was wondering if we couldn't have Mr. Wood address the comments that Mr. Lossie made in his opening, in his closing arguments about the back and forth between the department and and the Nordic staff on May 20th, that he was the comments, and it seems as though that'd be something we just want to make sure we can clear up if we can.
Sure. All of the any emails and documentation that was associated with that discrepancy between the 300-to-1 and 530-to-1 were shared with department attorneys, and I'm assuming that that information was turned over, because I was asked to turn over any emails that I had or any calculations that I had done. And I think Mr. Moeller and Ms. Brewer also, and we all had essentially had the same emails and documentation. So I'm assuming that all of that information was forwarded to the party.
This is Kevin Martin here. I can follow up on that to a little degree because Greg's referencing me here. We did receive a FOIA request from Upstream Watch back in June. The department did indeed respond in September, providing all of the emails that Greg referenced, including information such as call logs documenting calls between Nordic and department staff. Greg mentioned the staff that were involved with responding to that request, and it was responded to.
Ms. Jensen.
And I'll just note that there is a memo in the file from Mr. Wood to the board dated July 22nd that kind of memorializes some of the information that Mr. Losey referenced. So the board should have access to that memo.
Any other questions from staff, for staff from the board? Seeing Ms. Bertacci.
I'll look to Ms. Jensen. She might want to comment briefly in response to Mr. Losey's concerns about the use of special conditions. And it's my understanding that they are often including in waste discharge licenses as an opportunity to verify modeling.
Sure, I'll just kind of refresh the board's memory on something that I said at the last meeting. Let me pull my notes up here. That there are provisions in the law, in Maine law, that allow the board to approve conditions and waste discharge licenses. Specifically, Chapter 2, Section 19D authorizes the board, just in general, to impose any requirement as a license condition to provide for and ensure compliance with applicable laws and rules. Specific to the water context, Chapter 523, Section 4 of the department's rules requires the board, in addition to standard permit conditions, to establish conditions as required on a case-by-case basis to provide for and assure compliance with applicable laws and rules. And Title 38 MRS Section 414A-5A gives the board the authority to include conditions, a condition allowing for reopening of a license for inclusion or change of specific limitations when facts available upon issuance indicate that changed circumstances or new information may be anticipated. Again, that has been included by staff in this proposed order as special condition O. There are, just a note that there are allowances under state law that allow for conditions to be added to this license.
Great. Once again, I'll go to the board to see if there's any staff questions that you want answered. And seeing none, board deliberations. I suppose I would ask the question, is there any part of the application that is uncomfortable enough that it warrants discussion right now? And feel free to just speak off the top of your head, because you may trigger something in a board member that others may have some comfort or discomfort with. Okay, and I will just then launch into that a little bit, because this is probably the area where I've had the most time spent trying to get my arms around it. I think one of the challenges with this particular permit is that there really is no specific standard that you have to hit for some of these parameters. you can't degrade the waters below their classification. It was really difficult for me to understand, okay, what are the impacts of the bay naturally happening right now? There are the discharges from other places like wastewater treatment. There are three rivers flowing in. If you want to talk about changes in salinity, what happens during a 1-inch thunderstorm? It was difficult for me to really grasp just how much impact this bay was being asked to undergo. And what the department has to use is its best professional judgment on a lot of issues. So it's always going to be a little bit gray as to what the target is the applicant is supposed to hit. That doesn't show the application to me is deficient, but it does make it a little bit challenging and certainly warrants conditions put on after the fact just to prove and demonstrate that the technology is working the way it was supposed to. I got more comfortable, I think, with it when I realized what the department was using in their best professional judgment was some comparisons to what happens with studies done by the federal government and New Hampshire on the Great Bay Area, because that's a particularly productive estuary. And to use that as a comparison for a model gave me a certain level of comfort as well. That and the fact that the bay is being asked to take 20% or less of its assimilative capacity, I think probably made me more comfortable. Other thoughts from the board? Well, having seeing none, I think we can go ahead with a motion. I think the motion would be along the lines of a motion to approve Nordic's application for a main pollutant discharge elimination system permit, waste discharge license, and adopt the proposed board order and associated fact sheet, errata sheet, and any comments and corrections that Mr. Sanford has made. Is there somebody who would like to make that motion?
So moved. Mr. Pelletier.
So moved.
Mr. Parker.
I'll make that motion if it's, you can help with the wording.
Okay, if you can, it's been moved. Would you care to second it? All right, do you want to repeat?
Yes, I would. I'll second it.
Okay, and do you need a repeat of what the proposed motion was?
No.
Okay.
Proper.
Further discussion? Seeing none, we can move to a vote, and I'll start with Mr. Pelletier.
Aye.
Mr. Parker.
Yes.
Mr. Sanford.
Yes.
And I will vote yes, yes as well.
Okay.
Great. And I vote yes. So I believe that moves us on to the site law and NERPA permit.
It does. And again, can we take a brief break while we bring Mr. Draper and Ms. Lessard back? We need to contact them and have them rejoin the meeting.
Yes, take another 5 minutes, please. Reassembled. Our attorneys and staff are present, so I believe we can continue. And at this point, I believe we have staff ready to answer questions from the board. Let me just make sure that we have Nick Livesay here. You can simply wave. Mr. Livesay. Beth Callahan, project manager, is with us, I believe. Dylan Schultz, project manager. Don Hollowell, licensing and compliance, is with us. Dr. John Hopek is with us. Kevin Martin, compliance and procedure specialist, and Michael Parker, the environmental specialist as well. I believe they're all on board with this call. So if there's any questions, I think we can have Cindy introduce the topic to us once again.
Okay. Thank you. Finally, the board is considering Nordic's application for a site location of development, Natural Resources Protection Act, and Section 401 Water Clean Water Act water quality certification for its proposed project, both phase one and phase two. As with the other applications, a draft proposed board order was made available for a 30-day public comment period. And at your meeting on October 29th, the board discussed the draft order, the comments received on that draft order, and staff response to comment. Additionally, at that meeting, board members requested some additional revisions to the draft order. Department staff has considered the board's concerns and has prepared a revised draft with changes in response to your request. And those are shown in a redline version, which was sent to board members. Additionally, there is a memo that begins on page 43 of your packet, which lists where the additional revisions are found in the redline version of the revised document. And Mr. Livesay will review these revisions with board members and respond to any questions you may have regarding the revisions. This point, and some of them are fairly substantial, so I think Mr. Livesay will review those with you now.
Good morning. I'm going to walk through the memo that we provided you earlier that contains a rundown of the edits. And in that memo, we included the page numbers referring to the draft order. Obviously, we gave you this before we had the board packet number, so that I'm going to go with the page numbers that are on the draft order as opposed to the board packet numbers. Some of these are quite minor, so I'm not going to spend any time on them, but procedural orders come out faster than we can produce drafts, so we've updated the number associated with that. And actually, do the board members have this memo with them? Is it should I roll?
Yeah, I think you can go ahead and roll.
Okay. There's one little edit that we picked up in the interim that I'll note here that's not on your memo, and that is on page 12 of the draft decision, in the discussion of title right or interest, there is reference currently to quite title as opposed to quiet title. So we have all the right letters, just not in the right order. So that's one of those ones that spell check doesn't do you much good, but somebody with an eagle eye caught it. And so I guess I'd add that one to the mix, that it should be quiet title. I'll skip over the addition of two and A, and probably the change that we made that garnered the most attention during the prior deliberations is on page 48 or pages 48 and 49, with a corresponding change on page 94 to the condition. And this relates to the discussion we had about closure of the facility or what might happen if an unforeseen or unanticipated event occurs, and what's the appropriate way to plan and account for that. And so we listened and learned from the board at the prior meeting, and this is a topic that we kicked around at the staff level and gave some thought to. And one of the things I think that we heard from the board is that Nordic, in this proposal, it is somewhat unique. We're charting new ground in Maine and with newer technology. And so with that comes some unknown and risks that might be different than with an industrial facility that's using a technology that's been around longer, for example. And another form of sort of uncertainty that comes with this is just the scale of the facility. And in thinking about sort of those variables and what potential environmental impacts there might be, or impacts to human health that warrant consideration, we really landed on solid waste as being the principal one. And so that's what's reflected in this condition that you have before you, that requires development of an emergency response and closure plan. So think of it as sort of a contingency plan with a focus on making sure that if there is a die-off of fish or something during operations, that triggers a need for waste disposal at a volume that's greater than what's anticipated, how would that be handled? And the same goes for what happens if there's a unanticipated closure of the facility. I think that was a topic of discussion that came up as well. And so the recommendation that we have for you folks is reflected here in sort of the analysis in the condition language to develop this type of plan and have it be submitted to the department for review and approval. it could be done in a phased approach given the phased approach to the development that's proposed. One of the things that was talked about at the prior meeting is should there be a financial capacity component to this, required posting of a bond or some other form of financial guarantee. And that's something that we spent a fair bit of time thinking about and looking at how we've handled this sort of situation in other scenarios. And so we did not recommend financial capacity component to this condition. And in part, we did that because we haven't done it elsewhere. But of course, just because you know, if somebody says, why do you do something? You say, well, I've always done it that way. That's not the most satisfying answer. And so I'm not gonna just give you that for the answer, although that is true. Why have we not done that? And for projects like this one, there is no defined life. And by that, I mean, in the wind power context, for example, projects are built for a 30-year period effectively. They have a known shelf life. And sort of when the shelf life is over, we want to make sure that those projects are taken down. We also have express legislation in the wind power context, it's a little bit different as well. And so we really be charting sort of new territory here. And our sense is that if we're going to chart that new territory, having some further policy discussion would be beneficial, whether that's through rulemaking of the board or legislatively at the legislature. It's not to say that the board couldn't go in that direction, but it'd be a big shift and it might warrant some policy discussion. So that was our take on that. I don't know if you want to pause
before
the other items.
I would like to pause there. First, I'll see if any other board members wish to chime in before I do. Nope, seeing none. I think the department ended up in about the same place I did. First of all, I don't think we can get ahead of ourselves in what the policymakers at the state level, that is the legislature, to do something that hasn't already been explored through policy at the legislature level. I just don't think we can go that far. I was the one, I think, who brought up a number of cases, at least two cases where the owners were able to simply walk away from the building and the state and taxpayers were left on the hook. And both of those were essentially paper mills which were old. All the capital investment had been either ignored or sucked out of them. And there was not a whole lot there to preserve. In this case, this is new technology with a whole lot of debt. The concern that somebody's just going to walk away from all that is probably not realistic because somebody's going to want to keep that place warm. I think the short-term impacts of a disaster, such as a big fish die-off, that would probably be what concerned me the most as a future thing to be considered. I think the department does that here. While I was sitting here listening to you speak, I said, geez, that could be a lot of lobster bait. But that's for a discussion for another time. Looking around for other board members who may or may not wish to chime in on this, Ms. Lessard.
Just to say, I concur that I think that the department did a good job with hearing what the concern were. A lot of the concern related to an emergency operation plan that could deal with or at least provide some documentation that in the case of a large die-off or an emergency a shutdown unanticipated, that there would be ways to deal with the elements of this project, of this proposed project, that could have immediate negative impact in the community in which they're located. And so I think that the department did a good job in crafting some language that would provide for that eventuality to be addressed in such a way that everybody knows what that plan is. Not that Nordic didn't probably already have a plan or doesn't probably already have something in there, but this proposed condition makes that very transparent to the public and to the department.
Mr. Draper.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it again, but I concur with both, you know, Mr. Deschain and Ms. Lessard, that I thought the department did a good job addressing the concern that I had anyhow had raised at the previous meeting, and putting it in the solid waste section makes perfect sense now that I think about it. But you know, and some sort of financial assurance beyond what's already been referenced in terms of whether or not we even have the ability to do that is as a practical matter, trying to figure out what that dollar figure would be, you know, would it, you know, in terms of what I understand, landfills, there's a definition of what you need to plan for. You need to plan for closure of the facility. Well, I'm not sure we have a way of doing that in this facility. And, you know, I think as a practical matter, you would really, really get hung up on trying to figure out what that dollar figure should be. And I think this is a good approach. I think it addresses the concerns that I would have should something go awry, and I appreciate the staff's effort to put that in there.
Thank you for the feedback. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions from the board on that particular topic? And if not, any other questions for the staff on any part of this application? Ms. Lessard.
So Mr. Levesay has finished his, did he finish the list? Are we done with that? And now we're into questions on the overall.
I believe that's where we are, yes. Ms. Petracci?
I would note that there was Mr. Levesay's on page 69 and again a condition on 96 to address some of the concerns about private wells. And so there's some additional language there that the board members White might want to take a look at. If you look at page 69 of the packet.
For 69 of our board.
Yes, excuse
me. Draft order.
Yeah, 69 of the draft order.
We that was an instance where there was a bit of discussion about just ensuring the protection of private wells and sort of balancing the protection of private wells with not simply incentivizing replacement of them. I think there was a balancing there that we heard being discussed by board members. And so we've added some language in response to that, both, well, in two places, but it's just condition language that appears twice in the document.
I'm just taking a moment to reread that over again. Yeah, I think that lines up with what we were talking about. Ms. Lessard, you are unmuted and willing to continue?
I am. So overall, there are 38 proposed conditions on this draft order. And I need to be clear that it makes sure that I understand the parameters of all those 38 conditions. It's my understanding that conditions that cite the need for review and approval of the department are conditions of compliance that bring with them the ability for public input and comment and appeal. Is that correct?
So if it says review and approval, you are correct that the is an application that gets filed with the department, and we review it, and an order
is issued, finding that the condition's satisfied, finding that the condition's satisfied in part. Sometimes we might have a condition of compliance application that's where now a permittee says, hey, we meet conditions 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we might say, well, you meet 1, 2, and 3, but not 4. Or we could, deny the, find that they haven't satisfactorily addressed the condition. And certainly that can be appealed to the department. I think Ms. Benzinger commented previously that these condition compliance applications are sometimes subject to, well, the public always can comment on them. My understanding is that condition compliance applications aren't governed by Chapter 2 of our rules, sort of like a minor revision application. But I think it's, in talking with staff, it's fairly common practice on, I'll call it bigger ticket condition compliance applications, where there's been a contested proceeding that parties to that are given an opportunity to comment.
Ms. Benzinger, I think, wishes to jump in too.
And Mr. Livesey is right, and I think he's referring to the more ordinary types of applications. But if I might take a minute, we are, when you have a board proceeding and you've had a public hearing on an application, as the board has here, in Chapter 3, Section 30, your rule provides the following: any licensee receiving approval following a hearing must provide notice to all parties of the filing of any documents with the department indicating A, actions to comply with conditions contained in the license that require department review and approval. So that addresses your question. So all parties have to get notice of condition compliance applications and filings. But also, just out of interest, any proposals to amend a license when such a proposal was not part of the original decision within 1 year of the decision or the project start date, whichever is later, and any proposals to amend a license regarding an issue that was the subject of an appeal, if this is approved and there is an appeal, when the proposal is submitted within 3 years of the decision. There is a continuing transparency on a number of levels, and in particular for condition compliance.
Okay, I'm not trying to monopolize here, but I want to be clear on what this proposal involves. And the reason I ask that is, of the 38 items, 12 of them are identified with review and approval for the department, which means that an application is made, an order is issued, it's allowed, it's sent out for public review. What options exist for public input on that beyond just you can look at it? If these 12 items all have an application and they all have an order and they all are sent out to all of the parties, if it's not subject to Chapter 2, are you saying that they're not subject to any appeal provisions? What is the, you understand why I'm confused?
Yes,
about
yes.
They can appeal.
Yeah, they can,
so appeal. They can appeal to the board.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, so, and they would be, since they get notice when it is filed, the parties do, they would be able to submit information. They would see what is filed and they would be able to submit information contesting what was filed.
But theoretically, these 12 items could result in, from one side or another, 12 additional appeals.
Correct.
And probably fewer, only in that I would imagine some of these conditions would be satisfied at the same time. So there might be one appeal that captures four conditions.
Well, I asked because there are different times at which these conditions mm-hmm. are kick in. And so I don't know how they could all be filed at once because—
No, they wouldn't. No, but there's a lot of, you know, pre-construction or pre-operation of a phase, that sort of thing. So generally speaking, applicants or permittees, when they're satisfying those types of conditions, they do batch things together. And it's likely that that could happen here.
One final thing, and then it won't be the final, but it's for now, that, and then others can weigh in, is that what process is in place were this permitted to monitor and address 38 separate conditions? In my experience with the department, I've never seen an application with this many conditions that weren't just it can't be more than 4 feet tall or 5 feet wide, or, you know, something that's easily quantifiable, as opposed to a review and approval kind of issue. So that's my question. What is the department's capacity to manage a proposed approval with 38 different conditions on it that some of them are substantial?
Right. And so there are actually two categories of things. There's the monitoring piece, which is sort of a boots on the ground component to compliance. And then there is the review and approval component, which may involve visiting a facility depending on the nature of the condition. But it's also, it's more similar to the process we're going through now, which is review of a written submission, evaluation of whether it is doing, in this case, what's required of it based on the condition requirement, and then you know, documenting why it doesn't meet the standard. And so as far as, you know, capacity goes, I guess, you know, we would approach reviewing the condition compliance associated with this facility like we do with reviewing condition compliance requirements for all the wind power or all the solar projects we're permitting and all the other permitting matters we have. And that is basically we do the best we can with what we have. And so we'll continue to do that. I'm not going to tell you we wouldn't like to have more people to help us, but you know, that's for, we'll discuss that with other folks.
We can't fix that.
Right. You know, and so we do, and it's a balancing, right? I mean, we get condition compliance applications from folks fairly routinely, and when we get those, they are a priority. They're a high priority because it's often that those are, you know, a pre-construction or a pre-operation requirement, and folks are eager to construct and eager to operate, just like people are eager to get their permits too. So it's a balancing that we do daily, quite frankly, in terms of juggling workload and trying to be respectful of those who get in the queue first and are diligent, balancing that with urgency.
Thank you.
Both unmuted, Mr. Draper and Ms. Bensinger. Is there a legal point you wanted to raise, Peggy?
No.
Okay, then I'll go to Mr. Draper.
Yeah, I always let the attorneys go first if before I speak. So along the same lines, and these are the same questions I had. So Ms. Lessard, you know, just got to them quicker than I did. And I'm glad the 38 and 12 were the same count that I had. So I'm glad we can do our math correctly. And all on those same lines or the same vein, I guess, along through the process, this is going to be variable, I'm sure, depending on which condition we're talking about or that the department is reviewing. But if the department determines that one of these conditions cannot be or has not been complied with adequately, where does that leave the full license and the project? And again, I know there's going to be variances in that or variable circumstances depending on which one we're at. But, you know, what we're being asked to do today is approve a license that has these conditions. I guess with kind of an assumption, and I hate to say that, but with an assumption that they will be complied with. But what if they're not? What if the information isn't submitted? The information that's submitted isn't adequate. The condition isn't being met. What does that mean in terms of the license itself and the project? What status does that put it in?
So if there's a permit condition that requires something to be done before construction, they can't start construction until they obtain a condition compliance that says that condition satisfied. And so if they were to start without that condition compliance, they'd be in violation of their permit. If they apply and the department denies that condition compliance application, it's the same thing. They haven't satisfied it. So it's their meaningful conditions. If you need to do something, you need to do it. And if you don't, it's a violation of the permit, which is a violation of law.
Ms. Lessard?
Following up on that, again, of the 38, some are prior to construction, some are prior to operation, some are prior to construction of phase two, you know, but truthfully, once construction starts, environmental impact starts. So if you get all the way to construction and can't get by something that allows operation, the damage has been done, so to speak. And is there any concern at the department level that the very nature of the volume of these condition compliance, not the conditions. I understand 5 feet high, 4 feet wide, you know, those are easy ones. Is there any concern on the part of the department in this proposed that the unintended consequence could be an unmet condition in the middle after things had already started?
No, not really, and I'll explain why. And that goes back, I think, to a topic that was raised in one of the closing comments, and which is, you know, you can't. There's a burden on an applicant to satisfy the permitting requirements to obtain a permit, and not to sort of satisfy the permit requirements after the fact. And so I think what we've In the draft order before you, what we've tried to articulate, and in our findings that are reflected in that, is that the applicant has met the standards, and we're confident, we're not guaranteeing, but we are confident that the operation will work the way that it's been proposed. And so I think the conditions, we view them as, you know, the suspenders being added to the existing belt, if you will. And this goes, I think, to what Mr. Draper was saying. There is a high degree of confidence that an applicant can and will, both in this case and in others, satisfy the condition compliance. If we If we thought that they wouldn't, then I think they may not satisfy the permitting standard in the first place. That's not to say that you're not raising, a valid question, and it's not important to be sort of thoughtful and deliberative and understand the risks. And, nothing is guaranteed and nothing is certain, but I think that the department were comfortable and confident that Nordic will be able to deliver the project that they've proposed.
Thank you.
As Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify.
Yeah, that's a more succinct way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Bensinger, you're unmuted. You wish to jump in?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, great. Other question, Mr. Sanford.
Mr. Livesay, do you generally require permittees to keep the permits on hand with site plans on the site?
There are we do have pre-construction meetings, and Beth Callahan or somebody could probably speak to those even better than I can. But that involves, for example, meeting between third-party inspectors, department staff, contractors, permit holder, so that people who are engaged in various parts of the development activity know and understand what their obligations are. I don't know that we have a requirement that like a building permit for your house, you have to kind of post it on the door or somewhere. I don't know that we could go that far.
Like, for example, 38 has the landscaping plans on site. And I wonder if somebody were to come walk onto that site, should this thing get permitted and somebody was doing landscaping, would that person have the plans and know those conditions?
They should.
And do you normally expect permits and conditions to be kept on the site, like in the contractor's office or something, or just had on hand should you do an inspection or something?
So I don't know. I'm not familiar with an expectation that we have that every site law applicant keep a copy of their permit in the safe of their building or whatnot. And so I wouldn't want to speak to that. I'll leave it with, and Beth can chime in if there's more to supplement. But as far as the construction end of things, we do certainly want to meet with folks so that they know what their obligations are. After a project is developed, because there are oftentimes conditions that have ongoing requirements, right, beyond just the development phase, but speak to the operation phase. And I'm not aware that we have specific conditions or requirements as to where or how the permit is expected to be maintained. I'm thinking in particular of the many stormwater permits that we issue. We have a recertification requirement where people are supposed to check back in with us every 5 years, but I don't know that we have a specific requirement as to how it's kept. The physical document.
Ms. Callahan, I think, is ready to chime in on that point.
Yes, Mr. Livesay is correct. And all of that does tend to get discussed in a pre-construction meeting. And in my experience with sites that are in construction, every time I have visited, all contractors are ready to go with bid documents in hand, site plans, copies of permits, logs. It's always been common practice to have a binder ready to go for me to go through when I arrive on site. And a similar situation would be discussed in a pre-construction meeting.
Mr. Pelletier.
Thanks. I appreciate Ms. Lassard's comments and her review of this. I mean, for myself too, this tracking and following through on these and the department's ability to track and these things is one of those things that you have to consider. And yet what I see here is a process that's fairly comprehensive, and it's been, I believe, well thought out. And there is a opportunity for the public to review results and actually appeal. I mean, so the process itself, I'm relatively comfortable with. The boots on the ground kind of, approaches of reviews, as much as Ms. Callahan has said, is I agree. They usually, everybody you see in the field is well aware and should be aware, and these aren't inconsequential reviews that they're looking at. So I do have a certain amount of faith, but does the department have a point of contact with Nordic, a particular staff person there that they will be addressing any and all of these things with?
Callahan.
Yes, absolutely. At a pre-construction meeting, I always establish point of contacts, and that is made sure that all of those point of contacts are well known amongst not just department staff, but also third-party inspector, contractors, representatives. Absolutely.
But I understand that would be for construction, but we're going to have monitoring that's going to be going on, after we've got discharges out into the bay, and we'll be following different results. I'm assuming, again, that we've got a designated person that the department is working with, and just in terms of communication and good correspondence.
So in the paper mill context, for instance, oftentimes it'll be a mill manager that we would work with. And then there can be different levels of expertise within an industrial operation. The air people might have a particular point of contact that might be different from the wastewater folks or the land folks. And I don't think that there is a prescribed or uniform way that those contacts are always with the same titled person at a facility, if you will. It's a little bit more organic than that, depending on how a facility's org structure works and then how the responsibilities are kind of doled out within an organization.
I understand, and that makes a lot of sense for the types of projects we're looking at, and there's a large gamut of different things that go on out there. But for a project like this, with this number of conditions, perhaps Nordic might be interested in designating a particular compliance officer within the company that would be overall responsible to making sure that we are following through on these things in timely. I mean, it is quite a number of conditions that were put on, even though well thought out. There's an evolving schedule. It might be to their advantage to have somebody that we could always point to and be responsible to.
Seeing none further follow up from the department, any other board members wish to raise any other issues, question anything, discuss anything? I see none. Are we ready to proceed to a vote on this? I'll be looking for a motion. I see no objection to that. As I understand it, the motion would be along the lines of move to approve Nordic's application for a site location development Natural Resources Protection Act water quality certification and adopt the proposed board order as presented. And that includes with any changes. Ms. Bensiger?
Well, that could be one motion that could be made, but there could be a variety of other motions that could be made. As I said earlier, a motion to direct the staff to revise the order to add or subtract certain things or change certain things. It could also be a motion to direct the staff to draft an order denying the permit application. So right. There are a number of different motions that could be made.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was merely offering some wording on one particular motion, but anybody else on the board is willing, is free to make any other motion. Would anyone like to offer the motion that I suggested?
I will do that.
Mr. Parker.
I'll second it.
And Mr. Draper seconds. Further discussion?
So sorry. I didn't raise my hand. Go ahead.
I mean, Ms. Lessard.
You had started to speak, Mr. Draper. You can go ahead. I'll go after. Let's
apologize for that. It's just a general comment that I wanted to make, and that is we've heard, I guess perhaps throughout this process, that the application should have been deemed incomplete and returned to the applicant, or that the license should be denied because the application didn't include all the information that the department needed. And I think I just wanted to make a comment that in my experience, been through some relatively major projects, nothing quite on the scale of this, it's entirely typical to have a review process where the applicant submits information, the department makes comments, reviews it and suggests comments, and then there's this back and forth process of providing the information to meet the department's needs to make that finding. So I just want to make the point that I think ultimately that results in a better process and a better project and a better license, rather than someone saying you've got to meet everything 100% when you file the application. That just isn't probably going to be realistic. So I just want to make that point. I don't think the process of going through an extensive review process like that is at all unusual. It's very typical. It's already been said that, and I would agree, that having 38 conditions attached to a license is probably not typical, and could suggest that, you know, an application could have been developed, could have been better. Ultimately, we're not grading this. It's not A, B, C, D, it's or F, it's pass, fail, and that's the determination that we need to make. And to me, you know, you have to make that determination based on all the information that's in front of us and, you know, make the determination that this project's going to meet all the standards that we're asked to enforce. So I just wanted to make that point. That's all, I guess, is that I think that process has been robust and has been extensive and it's been long, but ultimately at the end of the day, hopefully it results in a better project.
Ms. Lessard?
I agree that with Mr. Draper that it's, you know, been a long and winding road, certainly. I would, however, offer that with 12 areas of conditional compliance, that this road is by no means at the end if the board approves this license, that the process, if approved, has the potential to be an additional, extremely long and involved process, particularly with some of the conditions that are cited. I understand the need for, I have significant concerns over how an approval moves forward in a way that is beneficial to either the applicant or to the interveners, who both have had a long road in this. Both, all sides very passionate in their beliefs about the information that they're providing. And the continuation of this, and if approved, this will be a continuation. It is in my mind that this approval, if this occurs, isn't a period at the end of a sentence. It's three more dots until the next appeal appears from one side or the other, if it's granted, depending on what occurs. So, well, I understand that the conditions are to ensure that what was supplied was right and all of that kind of thing. The fact that they're there and that they need to be there, this is just, it's not funny. I'm not laughing because it's laugh or cry at this point, but whatever happens today, this process is by no means over because the conditions of compliance afford the opportunity for continued intervention. And while if the permit is approved, the interveners may feel like they're going to just have to keep spending money and doing those kind of things to do it. My hope would be that if this is approved, that the level of effort on the part of the applicant is sufficient to address those concerns without an additional for 12 more appeals. It's more of a statement than a question, I guess, but it reflects my concern over 38 conditions and 12 conditional compliance items that is a very steep slope for the applicant, and it's an equally steep slope for any people on the other side of this issue who don't think it's a good idea. So just an observation.
No, and I think, speaking for myself, I think it's a very good observation. How do you regulate something this big? A traditional way might have been you build it out, and if you don't comply with your permit, you get this notice of violation. So that's how we regulate, notice of violation. In this particular case, I think we've gone a different route, which is to put on a lot of conditions, and some of them compliance conditions right in the middle of the project, but try to avoid that regulation by notice of violation later on. It is a bit of a different path because it's a modern facility with a lot of unknowns and it's big. I think that's how we ended up here. I'm looking around at the board members for any other opinions, concerns, questions. Seeing none, we do have a motion and a second on the table to approve. And I will take a vote. And I'll start with Mr. Pelletier.
Yes.
Mr. Parker. You were muted, Mr. Parker.
I'm unmuted now, yes.
Okay. Mr. Sanford.
Yes.
Mr. Draper.
Yes.
Ms. Lessard.
Yes.
And I vote yes as well. The motion is approved. Is there any other business? I would like to say a few thank yous, but is there any other business to take care of first?